Welcome to The Wonder, exploring perspectives, rituals, and observances of modern, naturalistic, earth-revering, pagan religious paths. Here are your hosts, Yucca and Mark.
Welcome back to The Wonder, science-based paganism. I'm Yucca.
And I'm Mark.
And this week we are talking about how to live your paganism. We're talking about the connection between paganism and lifestyle.
Right.
So, yep, we wanted to start by really talking about, first of all, what do we mean when we say lifestyle? Because that could mean a lot of things. That's a pretty huge word. And how does that intersect with our paganism personally?
Yeah, it's a big subject, and I expect we're going to have a really great conversation. So thanks for joining us today. So where shall we start? You want to talk about how your paganism informs your lifestyle, or shall I do that first? Or
why don't you take it away?
Okay. Well, I live in a suburban context, and it's one where my work is 12 miles away, so I have to drive a car. There is no public transportation that'll get me there. If there was, I would probably try to take it, even though it would take me 3 hours to and from. So a part of my understanding of how my lifestyle intersects with my paganism is that I am really committed to trying to reduce my footprint as much as I possibly can. I have an observational part of my paganism, which is about paying attention to the world around me, being aware of the cycles of nature as they happen in the region that I live. But then also I'm doing my best to try to minimize how much impact I am having on the earth. And it's a little hard because in order to survive, I have to do this 22-mile round trip every day, which I'm not super fond of. But to some degree, my lifestyle is subsidized by my previous lifestyle, which is that I did not drive until I was 25 and I didn't own a car until I was 31.
Wow.
Until then, it was bicycles and shoe leather and public transportation always. And that was deliberate. I wanted to have as little of an impact as I possibly could, and that was the way that it went. And when I finally needed to have a vehicle for work, I got one. And I've needed to have one for work ever since. But those 31 years of not regularly driving were kind of an accumulated bank of credit to some degree that I can rely on now and feel a little bit better about the fact that I'm doing this driving every day. I realize that a 15-minute commute is not, that's not a crazy length of time for people who are commuting. I'm sure a lot of our listeners right now are thinking, God damn you. if I had a 15-minute commute, I'd be very, very pleased.
Well, I know a lot of them have told us that this is what they do on their commute.
Uh-huh.
If they listen to us, so.
Right. Yes, so we should do something alarming every once in a while in order to keep people alert.
So you lived somewhere where you were able to do that, where you were able to not drive.
Well, I lived in the same town that I live in now. I mean, I live in a little bit more remote neighborhood than I did then, but the truth is that between just simply being broke and having grown up in a town where everybody gets around on bicycles, which is Davis, California, I was just accustomed to riding a bicycle everywhere, and that's what I did. I was really taking my life in my hands a lot of the time because people were not accustomed to bicyclists in this town at all. At that time, it's changed, fortunately. But really, the two main things that I have done in my life that have a direct impact, the choices that I've made that have a major impact in terms of my lifestyle's impact. That's I used the word too soon. On the earth are that I made those choices around transportation early on, and I have chosen not to have children, which is another huge energy and carbon impact if you choose to do it, because it's just inevitable. The more people there are, causing that footprint. So those are the choices that I've made. I don't necessarily say that that's what everybody needs to do, but right now, a lot of what my effort is about is trying to minimize waste, minimize plastic, minimize just the sheer amount of garbage that goes to a landfill as much as possible. And we do a pretty good job of it. We recycle really thoroughly, and we have a little can of garbage that goes out every week. That and the cat litter. So how about you? What would you say are your lifestyle choices informed by your paganism?
That's this episode, right? But it's a biggie. So first of all, these two things, they so overlap that sometimes it's hard for me to try and pick out which one I would call which. But fundamentally, I view myself as a member of the biosphere. I view myself as a member of my biological community. And I am not on planet Earth. Mm-hmm. Even though that slips into my language and slips into my framework, that's not actually a framework that I want to use and find very helpful. I think that I am part of Earth, and I am part of these systems. I don't live on the land. I'm not here on this planet for a brief period of time. No, I'm part of the planet that is briefly getting to experience itself. And I really believe in trying to be fair to the rest of the ecosystem that I'm part of. And of course, my perception of what is fair is informed by what animal I am and our instinctual and intrinsic ethics that our species has. There's ethics on top of that that are cultural, but there are certain ones that come down to simply being a Homo sapien. You know, I think we've talked about it a little bit on this episode before, but mm-hmm. ideas of things like reciprocity, that's very, the exact details of that become a cultural, but the idea of that is something that we as a species have. And we actually see that in some of our closest relatives as well. Mm-hmm. So I also like just hanging out with the rest of my ecosystem. So a lot of the choices that I make are choices that are going to enable me to do that. When it comes to lifestyle, there's also a lot of very practical elements where I look at how fragile the systems we're part of are. And I go, you know, I'm not interested in being at the complete mercy of these systems. So I'm interested in, and there's a lot of them that are working in a way that I think are very harmful overall to humans and the rest of our community, not just the humans. And so I'm interested in stepping out of those to a certain extent. I also am a rural girl. I grew up out in the county, in the country, and we would go into town. It's interesting when you talk about the driving. Where I live, it's very difficult to not drive just because we are so spread out. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I got my license when I was 15. and, you know, have had a car ever since. And that's beaten down cars that are always older than I am. I actually have a car that's younger than me right now. Barely. It's a 1990. So, but that's been a big part. But I guess, so there's a, that's a whole bunch of background to say that a lot of the choices that we're making right now are about trying to live in a way that we feel is fair to the rest of the ecosystem around us. And beyond that, I personally am not interested in just being satisfied with minimizing my impact or my harm that I'm doing. To me, I go, you know what? I think that, frankly, I believe that humans are brilliant, creative creatures and that we can do better than that. So I'm really interested in living in a way that can be regenerative. So how can I actually help heal the damage that's been done and create and spread more abundance within the systems that I'm part of? So I come from a rural situation and we are getting back there, but I don't think that people, we'll come back to this part later in the episode about what we like suggestions for people. I don't think that you have to go and do the same choice that my family's made, which is to live out of town, live on a bunch of land. We've got 25 acres, you know, I don't think that everybody needs to do that. That's something that we do because I like the privacy. I don't like being in the city where I have a neighbor right over there or that I can hear cars or things. That's uncomfortable to me personally. That works perfectly fine for other people. And I think that all kinds of situations can work out. But I think that there are a lot of choices that we can make that can start to really shift the overall way in which we're relating to the rest of the planet. So some of the things that we do, we really focus on the food aspect because when I think that there's a lot of really important big areas, but food is one that, well, first of all, agriculture is the primary way in which humans interact with the rest of the world, is our agriculture. We look at our land use. We look at what, you know, where our inputs and outputs are. It's in agriculture. And that's some place where we have a lot of influence in terms of our consumer decisions, but even taking it out of the realm of consumer. And then that's also the place where we're the most vulnerable. Without food, I mean, food is how you control people. And I think that the last few months, especially when the first few weeks of the pandemic really helped to open people's eyes around that a lot. You know, there definitely been small groups of people who had been, you know, waving the flags and saying, hey, we have a lot of vulnerabilities. What happens when? But, you know, something did happen. Mm-hmm. So we make the choice of really focusing on trying to eat from systems. And I really talk about systems very carefully, systems that are regenerative and beneficial systems. So often that means our backyard, right? Because that's the only thing I can be really sure of. But in northern New Mexico, where we are, there are some incredible ranches because, you know, I don't have the setup to do large animals on my own, but that I have visited and looked at as a range ecologist, looking at what they've been doing with the health of their soil and literally buying into those kinds of systems that are actually helping to rebuild diversity, rebuild the ecosystem functions. So that's the big place where we've got our effort. And then of course, I guess we've talked about a little bit before, our home that we are slowly in the process of moving to is an off-grid home. That's partly because we want to be away from the city, but also because that's the reality of the rural Southwest. Is there is no, we couldn't hook up to a grid up there because there is no grid to hook up to, right? The last power lines end 8 miles from our home, and well, there's no way that we could pay for it, and our neighbors would hate it too anyways. That's, you know, there's an aesthetic, but and you know, we don't have a well or sewage or because well, people have septic tanks out there, but you don't have a well because that's going to cost you $50,000 to dig. Mm-hmm. Right? And where are you going to come up with $50,000 for that? So it's all rainwater and that sort of thing. So it's partly practical, but also partly a choice of wanting to be as sustainable as possible.
That's great. And I really admire that. The piece about the larger systems is something that I have always done vicariously through public policy work. Looking at big systems like energy and agriculture and working to get better policies so that they work better with the systems of the biosphere. Mm-hmm. One example we have here, where I live is kind of a biotic tragedy in a way. It's very beautiful and it has a lot of wildlife, but the crop here is a monoculture of grapes. Mm-hmm. And grapes aren't really food. It's there to make wine, which is a value-added product, and it's a luxury. And this is some of the most fertile land in the world. Sonoma County used to be the breadbasket for San Francisco in the 19th century. It grew everything, mm-hmm. and shipped it down on rail cars. So keeping biotic land and rangeland from being converted into more of this monoculture is one thing that I focused on a lot when I was doing a lot of public policy work, with an eye towards biodiversity as sort of the metric for what constitutes a good policy. I don't do as much of that work anymore. I'm now working for a food bank that's feeding people with serious illnesses, and that's also worthy work. I still kind of have my ear to the ground, and I get involved in local electoral races and that kind of stuff in order to get people in office who have some kind of clue about what's really going on planet Earth, which is a lot harder to find than you might think.
Yeah. Well, you said a word in there, which is a biggie. You said monoculture. And I am very, very wary around trying to point to one thing or the other and say, this is the bad guy, this is the problem. Because I think that can get us into really tricky spots. And
sure.
Often that leads to a thinking that doesn't look at whole systems. And it's fun to be able and empowering to just find the one thing that somebody wants to think is the problem, whether that was, you know, the gays or meat or soy or whatever it is. But if there was anything, you know, if you put a gun to my head and said, what's the big problem? I would have to say monoculture. That, and again, we'll come back to like things that people can do, but the moving away from monoculture towards diverse systems, even outside of if we're not talking about agriculture, even beyond agriculture, I think that is so key in so many ways, because the monoculture means one life. It's supporting one kind of thing to the exclusion of all others. And when you have a very simple system, it's really, really simple to break that system.
Indeed.
And that's where I think there's a lot of potential that people have for, if you're looking for something simple and easy, is when making consumer choices, was this grown in a monoculture? Right.
Right. And unfortunately, in many cases, you don't really have a choice about that. The food that's available to you is stuff that was grown in a monoculture, and you can't really find many other alternatives. I'm fortunate here in that we have terrific farmers markets, with small producers producing extremely precious and expensive vegetables, but they are much more responsibly managing their land. And, you know, we have to say, too, there's something about crop agriculture that's not entirely cool. Crop agriculture is a deliberate effort to force all the insects, all the rodents, all the birds away from a patch of land so that you can grow an abundant supply of food, which nature wants to eat. But we want to keep it for ourselves instead. And so we use poison. They use cannons to drive birds away, to scare them away from the grapevines.
And it counts as organic. So
yes, exactly. Cannons are organic. Whoever would have thunk? So it's important, I think, for us to think for a moment about integrated food systems. One of the reasons, in my opinion, that food production is as out of whack as it is in the United States is that actual laws went into place that prevented integrated food production system farms. It used to be that a farm would have vegetable production and it would have animal production. And all of those were of a piece. You would feed the waste from the grain, you would feed the straw from the grain to the cattle, you would feed the scraps from the vegetation to the pigs, and all of it.
And then they would go back into the soil.
Exactly. They would go back into the soil and you would use their waste as a part of your fertilization system. And I'm not saying that it was perfect because, of course, you know, people had, you know, waste going into waterways and all that kind of stuff, but it made a lot more sense ecologically in terms of a closed loop system than the industrial agriculture we have now.
Yeah. Industrial agriculture is mining, is what it is.
It is.
It's not ecology. It's not working with an ecosystem. And it's annual based too. So it has to be, you have to be going in there and clearing the land every time. You have to, if you're growing annuals and you're only growing annuals, they require, annuals are the first step in succession. Mm-hmm. So in a normal system, when some sort of disaster or disturbance rather goes through, let's say a fire, a flood, a landslide, or your mammoth that knocks down some trees because they were really into that, right? It clears this land. Well, the first plants to move back in there are the plants that we turned into our staple crops. Because they're fast, they're easy, right? It's a lot easier to start up a lettuce farm than it is to build your nut tree farm that is got your animals moving through, your pig and acorn, to go with a kind of a traditional Northern European that at least many of my ancestors would have lived off of for centuries. So
indeed, yes.
But we are in a time period where we're starting to talk about this kind of stuff, right? You can learn about this. It's not this unknown, forbidden, forgotten knowledge. And that to me is very hopeful, that it's something that people, that not everybody yet, but at least there is that right now the listeners could look up perennial regenerative agriculture and come up with so much to learn and read about, and then to actually apply.
Yes. So. Yes. And some of this goes to the question of diet and what we should be eating. And that's definitely a piece of lifestyle as we talk about lifestyle and paganism. Mm-hmm. And there's a great deal of controversy over that. Mm-hmm. My personal take is I've never seen an animal in the wild that won't eat what it's capable of eating. Mm-hmm. The only animal that we know of that will choose not to eat what it is able to eat is a human. The question is what proportion of various kinds of food should we be eating? Because when we evolved, the opportunity to eat meat was kind of far and fast between. It was something that was rare, and it was a highly dense calorie source. And you gobbled it down as quickly as you could, but most of the time you lived on roots and berries and leaves and stuff like that. And so there's lots of talk about diet. Mm-hmm. And one thing that I really caution people about when we talk about diet is the idea of the magic bullet diet that works for everybody. It doesn't exist. It just doesn't exist. I mean, if you're going to go to a bunch of Inuit people living, you know, way out on the peninsula in Alaska and tell them now you're going to live on beets and kale, it's just not going to work. You know, they've evolved over generations to be able to live on a particular kind of diet. And that's the kind of diet that they need to have. One of the things that's been very destructive for indigenous people in this country has been the supermarketization of our food economy, mm-hmm. where all this sugar becomes available and all this kind of waste calorie food that's very, very bad. And people eat it and they get diabetes and they get sick, you know. It happens to everybody. It's not just indigenous people. It happens to everybody. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah. So, I mean, I think there's a lot of components to that whole question. And the anthropologic story of the proportions of what humans were or were not eating is not a settled matter, for sure. No. There is a lot back and forth around that. And it's really tempting and easy to find one of the ways of eating and assume that that's going to be the best health-wise for everyone, and assume that that's going to be the best for the whole planet and all of that. But I really caution, like you're saying, caution against that kind of thinking, because it doesn't take into account the diversity of people and the diversity of landscapes, the diversity of where people live. And it also is real easy to slip into this idea of thinking that a certain kind of food itself is bad for the environment, instead of looking at how is that food produced. Mm-hmm. Because you can take the same item, right? We could talk about almonds, and you can look up the problem with the almond irrigation and the everything that's happening with the insects and all of that. And an almond grown in that situation versus the almond in the tree, coming from the tree in my backyard, are completely different. Mm-hmm. And that's really the case, especially with meat. When people talk about, meat is so bad. And it really depends on how it's produced. And it also, it depends on who's telling the story, because there's a lot of folks who really want to push one particular story and may not be completely fair in the way that they present the information. For whatever that reason is, maybe it's because they are the owner of the largest pea protein company in the world, or because we want an answer. We're scared and we want something that works. But I think that it's really difficult to say that there's a blanket answer for everybody, right? And that, you know, that it's really more important to look at how the particular thing that you are eating was made, not some value or virtue signaling about it.
Yes, yes. So. Yeah, I think that's very well said. The one thing that we can say with some certainty about the biosphere is that there is an exception to everything. The diversity is so astoundingly complex that any rule that you devise about how creatures live or must live, there will be an exception to. And that gets down to, you know, animals that metabolize copper or iron sulfites and don't need oxygen at all. So I agree with you that people do want an answer, and people also want to feel virtuous. And being able to hold an ambiguous position that's much more nuanced and looks at specific cases and then makes judgments based on criteria around how well that works with their local ecosystem is not really as much of an opportunity to feel virtuous. It's more of an opportunity to feel kind of curious and to always be in a state of exploration.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think that that can be, you know, simultaneously very empowering to look at the world in that way, but also terrifying. And I think that it's easy to feel lost, right? Because buying into whatever it is, whatever the particular, you know, kind of dogma is, that like you can at least feel like you're doing something.
Right.
Even. Right. So it's really, it's tricky, right?
Yeah.
And there's so many different approaches, but one thing that I would suggest for someone who's feeling just completely overwhelmed is, always get your connection time with your ecosystem, but to choose one area and just start in your one area and not feel like you've got to solve everything all at once, or that you've got to completely change your entire life cycle, lifestyle, that there might be something. Like it sounded to me like, Mark, you were saying one of the areas that you've really put a lot of your effort in is the transportation area. And I was saying, for me, that isn't where we've put ours. We've put ours in this other area. And that's a perfectly valid and sane approach to take.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the other piece of that is you don't have to reinvent the wheel, because there are people out there that are doing the stuff that you're curious about already, and you can learn from them.
Have a YouTube channel.
Or at least a website.
Yeah.
At least a website. There is a dairy in my region called the Strauss Family Creamery. And they are extraordinary range conservationists, all organic cream and milk and cheese production. They produce their stuff in glass bottles that people return for a deposit. It's a completely different model than the sort of industrialized milk production. And as far as I'm concerned, why would you kick those people off their land? You know, what you would, if in the name of environmental protection, you were to kick those people off their land, what you would get is a bunch of thatch and brush and lower biodiversity than what you have when you have these large ungulate grazers moving across and pooping on the land and continually fertilizing it.
Yeah.
So, and
that's been a tragedy that's happened in my area, actually.
Is it?
Where folks in the name of environmentalism have removed ranchers who have been there for literally hundreds of years, not understanding that the ecosystem needed those grazers. And that we've seen tremendous, you know, they shout about it like it was this incredible victory and how wonderful, and we've stopped the overgrazing, but now there's undergrazing and the land is in even poorer shape than it used to be.
Right.
Because it's not black and white. It's not cattle are bad. It's, well, if you manage cattle poorly in whatever way, you're going to hurt if you manage it poorly, that's the definition of poorly, that's going to hurt the land. But you can use that same tool in an incredibly healing way, or you can do it in a way that's going to really hurt. So
exactly. And once again, you know, I go back to the challenge of viewing things through a lens that sees nuance, because we all want an answer. We all want to know, okay, this is the good thing to do. This is the bad thing to do. When I see two products on the shelf, this is the good product and that's the bad product. And the world just doesn't really work that way. There are people that are making a real effort at responsible environmental stewardship in the course of producing food products. And then there are people who don't care at all. And being aware of who those are is it's an effort.
Yeah. So we actually, I guess we've spent most of this time talking about the food part of it all. But I wanted to come back to something that you said at the beginning, and I think this might be a place where, I don't know if it's somewhere where we're going to have a little bit of disagreement or not, but it's the area of children. Hmm. And I'm someone who chose to have children because I don't completely buy the idea. In fact, I don't buy the idea that having children or having more people is necessarily bad for the environment, because we can look at different populations, and I don't have the exact numbers with me written down here, but we can look at how much resources Americans use versus choose another country, Costa Rica, right? Per capita, or any, you know, we can look and compare between different countries. And it comes down to a matter of resource management. Now, obviously, at some point, a carrying capacity for the rock that is our finite planet. But that I think that the way that we live, the choices that we make, somebody with children and those children could be using many fewer resources than somebody who chose not to have kids, or the other way around. That it's, so I personally am very wary of painting larger population with the brush of automatically being bad for the environment. Because I think it gets back to that idea of, do I believe that humans, the best that we can do is just do less harm, or is the best that we can do beyond that? Can we restore and spread more abundance? So,
well, I guess I understand that, but I would also say that you're not raising Costa Ricans. And, you know, there comes a point where children become adults and they go off into their own lives. And in the U.S., what that tends to mean is they get education. They go into some kind of value-added work, which tends to involve more energy consumption, more resource consumption. And then they begin to consume products. And we have a lot of work to do in the way of education to convince people that owning products is not the definition of a successful or well-lived life. But for the most part, that is the myth that persists in our society. Mm-hmm. And so what I know for a fact is people that don't exist aren't consuming. I'm very clear that, you know, the children that I did not have are not having an impact. Sure. I'm also one of seven children.
Mm-hmm.
Some of those branches really needed to be cropped. There was just way too many. My father was an irresponsible person. I'm a big believer in people having their own choice around this, and I'm not telling other people that they shouldn't have children. I get a little side-eyed when I see people with 5, 6, 7 children. That seems a little much to me, but that's just my own prejudice. The main point for me is that the current kind of cultural prejudice against people choosing not to have children has got to go. Particularly women get hammered about this because they choose not to have children. And
yeah, we have no right choice that we can make, right?
Right, exactly.
We get judged for having them, judged for not having them, and you know, culturally penalized no matter what.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's just nonsense. So that's got to go. But otherwise, people have to make their own call based on their own criteria.
Yeah. Well, and I certainly would never want someone to think that, you know, that I would be judging them for choosing not to. That's a very, very personal choice.
Mm-hmm.
But I think going back your argument about that they're being raised in this culture and this culture tends to do, you know, these set of things. I agree. But what I think is that it's anyone in this culture in the form that it's in, and the culture can grow and change and shrink and morph in many different ways. And that may be because people come in and join the culture, or the culture spreads to other areas. And so the choices that we make can start to change the culture. So yeah, do I have control over what my kids do when they get older and grow up? No. And I have a less control than I'd like to imagine of what they do right now, even as young as they are. But I think that I really do believe that more minds and more people sharing those values and understanding it and living it on a real deep level is a, from my perspective, a positive for our culture overall.
Sure. I can understand that.
Right. And I'm certainly not saying that this is what you are doing at all, because I don't get this sense from you, but I sometimes from other people, when they talk about the overpopulation problem, I sometimes hear a little bit of, what's the word?
Misanthropy.
Misanthropy in that, and I'm wary of that belief that we are bad and that we are a cancer and that the individual doesn't matter, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's just one of those, just speaking to the idea. I know that was not what you were communicating, but
no.
It's something that I sense in that conversation sometimes, in the larger conversation, that saddens me, and that I'd really encourage people to look at in themselves when this conversation is coming up, and seeing if that's something that they're feeling, and if that's something that they will want to feel or not, you know, do they believe that? So.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I'm a big believer in cultural transformation because I'm working to do it really hard, actually. A lot of what my effort is put into is working to get sensible values out into the society and to, you know, have that be presented as an alternative for people as opposed to what they're spoon-fed when they're growing up. For myself, I mean, there are so many factors that went into my decision that it's probably not a very good case. I mean, my upbringing was an utter nightmare, mm-hmm. you know, very abusive. And so I didn't have any confidence that I would be a good parent either, because the example that I'd seen was so terrible.
Yeah.
So, you know, on balance, it just made the most sense for me not to do this. But that said, obviously, I mean, I'm less worried about so-called overpopulation because Malthus is right. That's going to solve itself.
Sooner we don't change our resource management.
That's right. If we continue to consume at the rate that we are, then people are going to die. And it's going to be horrible. So hopefully we will work out some kind of a more sensible approach to resource consumption and management, which is what I'm all about. So I don't worry so much about that as I do about the question of consumption and and of course the question of carbon, which just hangs over everything.
Yeah. Well, and that was a big reason for us as a family why we chose to get land. You know, we were in the miraculous, you know, that's another story for another time of how that actually was able to become a reality. But that was a big reason why it was a dream of ours to get land, is because now we are the stewards of this land. Mm-hmm. And it's got a lot of carbon potential there.
Great.
So, that's yeah, great. And that's what I haven't been doing it with the last couple of years, having the children and not really being able to see people in person. But that is, as a private ecologist, that's what I've done working with landowners, is helping them in their management, in their grassland restoration, to actually start to bring back and start to build up that soil a little bit. And that's where the carbon's really at.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I mean, because carbon is, you know, we talk about carbon as a bad word right now. It's a scary word, but carbon is also life.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, it's in the wrong place right now for life as we like it and know it. We have taken it out of the life and we've stuck it up in the atmosphere, and that's not where it's going to be helping us. That's right. Sending us in the direction of Venus, right? We need to,
right,
to bring it back and put it back in the soil and put it back in living things. And that's what the soil is. Soil is alive. Soil is life.
Yes, it is.
Dirt, that's your sand, silt, and clay. Soil is the system, is the entire ecosystem. So.
Yep.
Yep.
Absolutely. So where are we for time?
Well, we're a little longer than we normally are, but I definitely want to cover just a little bit of just a couple of things people can do, even if it makes us go a little over time.
Sure.
Just because, you know, we've been talking about our situations, but yours and my situation, it's just, we're just two people out of literally millions, right? And so there's a lot of people who are in high-rise apartments or in, you know, suburban environments and all kinds of different places. So I just wanted to touch on ideas that we have for people to really bring their paganism, their values into the lifestyle a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So are there any kind of, I guess, elevator pitches or podcast pitches that you have on those?
Well, the first one for me always is pay attention. learn what's happening in your local environment. And it doesn't matter if you live in a high-rise apartment, there is still stuff happening in your city, whether it's just the sycamore trees along the avenues that are turning brown and are losing their leaves. There is always stuff that is happening. And so being aware of those changes becomes really important. And then the other is just being aware of how much stuff you go through every day, whether it's gasoline or water or whatever it is, just being aware of those impacts can help you to make decisions about turning off the water while you're brushing your teeth and then turning it back on to rinse your toothbrush in your mouth. That doesn't sound like it's much, but when you multiply it by hundreds of millions of people, it's a lot of water.
Yeah, 365 times a day, days, twice a day, yeah.
Exactly, and in large metropolitan areas, that can make a gigantic difference. You know, be aware of where your water comes from and where it goes. There's no such thing as away. So don't think that by putting something down the toilet, you're sending it away. What you're doing is you're sending it into receiving waters, which could be a river or could be a bay or into the ocean. And those chemicals don't magically disappear. You know, whatever it is that you put in there doesn't magically disappear. So, you know, caustic toilet cleansers and, you know, perfumed things that people put in their toilets and, you know,
Detergents,
shampoos full of microbeads. Just be aware of what you're using and try to use something that is not as impactful, that's made with stuff that's natural and breaks down and won't, you know, will leave the stream that is leaving you as clean as possible. It won't be clean because we all excrete and so forth, but it could be cleaner. And that's a sacred task. It's an honorable task. It's a way of saying to yourself, I really do value the earth. And by doing these specific things, these are gestures that I make in honor of my relationship with the earth.
It's beautiful.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So how about for someone living in a rural area, a generic rural area, which of course doesn't exist.
Sure. Well, you know, my answer actually, well, what you said about the observation, I think that would be the key. Wherever, whoever is just really being present and just setting aside a moment for that in your daily life, but also just having that moment. But if there was one thing that I could suggest to someone, whether you are in that high rise or whether you are somewhere 50 miles, 2 hours, whatever from a city, is composting. And that's going to look different depending on where you are. Somewhere where you've got plenty of space and you've got lots of biomass, you can do your big hot piles and you can really get into all of that. But if you're in a tiny apartment, you can do it with worms. Little vermicompost, all it takes is a tub the size of a little waste paper basket underneath your kitchen sink. And I love compost for the actual impact that you're making. Your food is not being trucked to a landfill and then you're dealing with all of that situation, if it's a landfill or out to sea or whatever's happening with it. But it's also connecting you back in with the whole cycle. Because that's one of the things that I think that's the big thing that we've lost in our modern urban and urban influenced, because a lot of times when we live out in the country in a rural situation, we're still living in an urban way. We just have a longer commute. Mm-hmm. But that's something that we've lost, is the full cycle. We are in our urban environment. We're just in the consuming part, which is a part of the cycle of nature, right? Sure. The cycle of life and death and decay, and from decay, new life happens, right? And that decay part and the regeneration, we're missing that on a daily basis. But with the compost, that's happening.
Mm-hmm.
You can't avoid it. That's what is happening. And it can be done in any situation. Your college dorms would probably not allow you to, but I'm sure you could do it there if they didn't know. And at the end, you have an economic product. If you don't have a garden to put it in yourself, then if you have a worm bin and you advertise on Facebook or Craigslist that you've got worm castings, that'll get picked up. Right. So I think that would be my biggie, is really saying that wherever you are, you can pull off that composting. Mm-hmm.
Sure.
So maybe not on a Navy ship, but everywhere else.
Well, this has been another super great conversation with you, Arwen. I've really enjoyed it.
Me too.
Yeah, thanks for this.
Yeah.
And next week, we are going to be doing something a little bit different. We're going to do a couple of guided meditations. So if you're used to listening to the podcast while driving, we're going to encourage you to not do that next week, because operating heavy machinery while you're going off on an inward journey is not the safest thing in the world. And we'll give you a warning in next week's podcast as well. But we hope that you'll enjoy that. We think that we have some interesting places to take you. And remember, you can always reach us at thewonderpodcastqs@gmail.com. So thewonderpodcastqs@gmail.com. And we welcome your comments and suggestions. In the meantime, I'm Mark.
And I'm Yucca. And thank you.